Chapter 17. The Most Colossal Folly. The advance of German troops across Belgian territory would furnish liberal turncoats like Lloyd George with an occasion for pious indignation that was typical of the British establishment. Britain's leaders well knew that Germany's only possible strategy against France necessitated the violation of Belgium's neutrality. Great Britain was no stranger to the use of force and the abrogation of treaties to advance the aim of its elite, everywhere from Ireland to Hong Kong. France had violated or laid plans to violate Belgium's sovereignty 20 times throughout her history. The man most concerned, Belgium's King Albert I, would lash Poincaré after the war in these words, "I am most fond of Mr. Poincaré, who continues to talk as though all the overweening ambition and evil were on one side, whereas just a few days ago he stated that it was only because of his veto that the French General Staff had not invaded Belgium in 1914, and that he deeply regretted it." In fact, Germany saw herself hemmed in between two giants about to crush her. The Manchester Guardian had enough courage to write on August 3, 1914. "We shall pass no harsh judgments on what a man or a nation does when it's a matter of life or death." However imprudent Kaiser Wilhelm II had been in his choice of words, he had done everything in his power to avert a war, while Churchill and his allies strove ceaselessly to bring on a bloody conflict that would leave Europe prostrate. At their behest, on the evening of August 3, at 7 p.m., Britain's ambassador, Sir Edward Goskin, presented himself at Bethmann Hollweg's office in Berlin and demanded that Germany respect Belgian neutrality by retreating from the country, on pain of war with Great Britain. The next morning in London, Lichnowsky received his passport and the United Kingdom's declaration of war at one and the same time. The document stated that the German Empire had declared war on Great Britain, a complete misstatement of the truth, which brought a hurried substitution of the corrected document for the inaccurate one by a secretary from the Foreign Office. On the 4th, the Manchester Guardian ran a full-page appeal by the League for Neutrality on the theme, "Englishmen, do your duty and keep your country out of an evil and stupid war." Mrs. Asquith noted that Winston Churchill was looking very happy. "General Sir Henry Wilson predicted, in 4 weeks we'll be at Elsinbourne." "3 weeks," retorted the French General Berthelot. Other predictions were being made by more perceptive minds. Josiah Wedgwood prophesied, "You will see something much more important than a European war. You will see a revolution." Before the Russian Duma, an obscure delegate named Kerensky cried, "After you have defended your country, you will liberate it." In the far north of Siberia, on the banks of the Yenisei, a convict laid traps for foxes and field mice in the snow. Unknown to anyone in the West, he echoed the sentiments of the leftists in the Duma, "The Tsar's war will be the proletariat's good fortune." His name, among revolutionaries, was Joseph Stalin. The men who would lead the October Revolution had left Russia and were living abroad, watching and waiting. Lev Davidovich Bronstein, alias Trotsky, was living in Vienna. Warned by the Austrian socialist Victor Adler that he would be interned the next day, he fled to Switzerland on August 3. He would soon be joined by Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, alias Lenin, at that time holed up in Austrian Poland. Lenin would spend most of the war living across from a sausage factory in Zurich. From there he would set out in March 1917 towards world revolution and history. The vast majority of Europeans gave little thought to the possibility of political and social cataclysm triggered by the war. The masses marched off to massacre with patriotism in their heads and savagery in their hearts. Years after the carnage, most of them would be no wiser. As the eminent French Senator d'Estournelles would exclaim before the International Court at The Hague in 1921, "Our public opinion has been so saturated with official lies that people can't wake up to the light and see the truth all at once. They wouldn't believe it." As early as October 1916, Woodrow Wilson would write, "The singularity of the present war resides in the fact that its origin and its objectives have never been revealed. History will have to search a long time to explain this conflict. Bullet, President Wilson, page 280. But Wilson, too, would lead his countrymen lemming-like into the carnage. Naturally, the victors had little desire to see the web of subterranean maneuvers, and the brazen lies which they had told in order to lead their peoples into war exposed. Nor did they wish to see overturned the harsh peace they imposed on the defeated, lest they be denied the billions of marks in reparations they had planned to exact. If the Germans are proved innocent, asked Poincaré, why should they want to pay war damages? Yet not long after the war, a growing consensus of honest scholars, from the victorious nations as well as the vanquished, would give the lie to the claims of Germany's exclusive guilt, which had been incorporated into the Versailles Treaty, as well as to the pretense of French, British, and Russian innocence. On his own country, the French historian Fabre Busse would pronounce the verdict: France isolated herself in a lie. On August 4, 1914, the actors were all arrayed on the stage of Europe, the just mingled with the unjust, the artless with the false. First the Tsar, hanging his head, glassy-eyed, and bedecked with ribbons. He was not responsible for much, he was merely the front man of Panslav firebrands, the Grand Dukes, the Sazonovs, and a whole ruck of certified scoundrels like Lzvolsky and Hartwig. Beside the Russian monarch, the oft-grumpy Tsaritsa in her wimple, the fine-looking grown daughters afflicted with hysteria, and a hemophiliac child, all of whom, buffeted by misfortune, would, in 1918, pay for the Russo-Serbian trap of June 28, 1914 by being horribly massacred by a Bolshevik murder squad. Opposite, in his plumed eagle helmet, was Wilhelm II, who had been more relentless than anyone in his efforts to prevent war. He would be tossed onto the scrap heap of history as a scapegoat, as a leper to be stoned and charged with the crimes of the real instigators. In the background, artfully blurred by fog, the last one to arrive was Britain's George V, who lacked nerve, standing beside Churchill, who had it to burn, and who was scenting battle as if preparing to enjoy a savory and sumptuous repast. The massive Pashik, ever cautious, was hiding the revolver of Sarajevo under his dirty beard. One lone Frenchman, the most brilliant of Frenchmen, the future Marshal Lyautey, had started back, horrified at seeing the ghastly spectacle about to begin. "They are completely insane," he had exclaimed on receiving the order from Paris to be ready for full-scale action. "A war between Europeans is a civil war. It is the most colossal folly the civilized world has ever committed." The vicious Treaty of Versailles imposed on Germany would finally bring to the chancellorship of that nation, on January 30, 1933, a volunteer infantryman of 1914. It would raise him to power and bring on the sequel. That sequel would be the Second World War, the accursed and ineluctable fruit of the First World War. But before everything else, there had been the two revolver shots of Sarajevo. They destroyed forever an entire world.